This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Good morning, I'm Mitch Tine.
And I'm Bonnie North. One of the oldest still-spoken languages on Earth faces an uncertain future. A group of scholars meeting this week at Marquette University, however, is working to preserve both the language and the cultural traditions that accompany it. The language is called Syriac, and it holds both religious and historical significance.
The two-day event is called Mapping Ancient Lives and Social Networks, a digital workshop, and includes a public keynote address this evening. Among the experts guiding the effort are Marquette's Jean-Nicole Mellon-Saint-Laurent, along with Dan Schwartz of Texas A&M University and Nathan Gibson of Vanderbilt University. They are with us in the studio to explain. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you for having us.
So let's just start with a basic question here. What is the historical significance to the Syriac language?
So Syriac is a dialect of Aramaic, so it's related to what the ancient Assyrians spoke. It's also quite closely related to the language that Jesus would have spoken, so very much connected to the Levant in the first century. As a literary language, Syriac flourished from about the 3rd century to the 8th or 9th century, but continues to be used today as well.
What do we know about how prevalent it is, how commonly it's spoken, and where it's spoken today?
It is spoken today by many of the Christian minority groups who live in the Middle East. So that would include Christians living in Lebanon, in the Holy Land, in Jerusalem, so Palestinian Christians, Iraq, parts of southeast Turkey, parts of Iran, and of course Syria.
You said it's related. It's a dialect of Aramaic. Are either of these languages, are they subsets of any modern day languages? How do they relate to, say, Hebrew and Arabic?
Well, they're in the same family, the Semitic language family, as Hebrew, Arabic, and ancient languages like Akkadian. So they're moderately closely related, but you still have to take a lot of effort to learn them separately as individual languages.
Would French and Italian be a nice analogy?
I think that would be good.
They're pretty closely related, but obviously two distinct languages.
But if a modern day Hebrew or Arabic speaker heard someone speaking Aramaic, they might pick some of it up.
Maybe a couple words.
Yeah.
You'd have to learn a new alphabet, too.
Mm-hmm. So the word for peace in Syriac is shlomo, which is, you know, mm-hmm. very much sounds like shalom right. in Hebrew. Right. Yeah. So there are definitely some close relationships.
Tauti is like todah.
It has not, though, been an official language in any country for quite some time, correct?
That's right.
That is correct.
If its heyday, its heyday has been passed for hundreds of years. What were the pressures initially that led to its decline, and what are the pressures that it faces today?
Well, actually, can we jump to before the pressures?
Absolutely.
First, before we
sure.
get to pressures? I think one of the most important things to recall about this language is that it's in that Fertile Crescent region, that place where so many different civilizations have met and mixed, and that from its earliest period, it's in dialogue with both the Greek-speaking Mediterranean world to the west, the Persian-speaking world to the east, and is a bridge in many respects. And so we have a great deal of Syriac preservation of translation of Greek works into Syriac, ultimately from either Greek into Arabic or Greek into Syriac into Arabic. So Syriac as a language is really closely related to some very important movements in Mediterranean intellectual, theological history in a number of different ways.
Well, and so let me ask this. Did Syriac change over the years? I mean, just the same way, you know, an English speaker today might be puzzled by Old English, is the Syriac that is still spoken by a lot of minority Christians in this region the same as the Syriac that was spoken in, say, the 3rd century?
There are definitely differences. So one of the challenges that we face is that Syriac has such a long history, and most of the resources that we have are for the really early period. Mm-hmm. So when we get into the medieval period, especially the late medieval period, and then when we deal with the modern dialects spoken by communities in the Middle East, we really run into a lack of resources and a lack of knowledge. So that's one area where we would like to expand the scope of Syriac study.
It's interesting to note that, for instance, in areas like southeast Turkey, there's a region called Tur Abdin. That's a place where there's a lot of monastic life. And the monasteries have been really important in resurrecting classical Syriac as a spoken language. And so if you were to travel to Turabdin today, for instance, you can hear the monks speaking it among themselves. And they try to teach the children of the villages the language as well.
Well, so then let's return to the historical pressures that led it to be overtaken in some cases and the modern day pressures that make this work especially important to do today.
One of the things that contributed was that Arabic became the language that was spoken all across the Near East. So Syriac had that role. Previously, we have thousands and thousands of texts in Syriac. But as Arabic became dominant and everybody learned to speak Arabic, Syriac was no longer necessary in that role. But then also the Syriac communities tended to be especially Christian communities. And so as the religious demography changed over the course of several hundred years, Syriac declined but continued to be used alongside Arabic.
And then today, clearly there are some geopolitical pressures that are making this work especially important.
Absolutely.
It's a bit of a tricky situation insofar as I think one of the things that's tremendously important to keep in mind is that for centuries, for many, many centuries, there were thriving Christian and Jewish communities throughout the Middle East. And in some regions of the Middle East, that is becoming less and less the case. But in some ways, that's a fairly recent phenomenon. And so that's the first thing, right? I don't want to sort of overemphasize the Islamic nature of the Middle East because it's a highly diverse religious region, you know, throughout centuries. And so what I think we see happening today is a constriction of options because of movements like ISIS and those sorts of extremist elements that the option of being a Christian has become more difficult. And there's no question that certain religious minority groups, Christian, Yazidi, a number of others as well, have been targeted by ISIS and put a tremendous amount of pressure on those communities.
It isn't uncommon that the very texts that we're reading about, the monastic places and so on, we'll be studying or reading about them in our own work, and then the next day they're on the news because they've been attacked. So there's obviously an immediacy to the importance of this work. And one of the things that makes our field different from, say, classical studies is that there's a living heritage of people that are the true heirs of this tradition. And so that gives it an immediacy importance.
Well, and that's kind of a perfect transition to what you're doing in the very here and now this week at Marquette. Talk about the kinds of scholars that have come together for this workshop and what you're hoping to accomplish over a couple of days of intense work.
So we have close to 30 scholars and librarians from, let's see, the United States, Canada, France, Germany. Am I missing any?
That's it, yeah.
And a nice mix of graduate students, faculty, librarians, as I mentioned. And we are involved with a project called Syriaca.org that is seeking to create what's referred to as core data, identifying entities in this field. So persons, places, manuscripts, works, things of that sort.
This is where digital humanities
comes
in.
This is where the digital humanities comes in, absolutely. And we are creating the infrastructure for a variety of projects in the field to link up data. And the reason that's so important is there's actually no one of us here who's involved with this, but we have other projects that we work with that are doing what I guess you could call rescue codicology, right? So going and collecting high-quality images, training the people who own those images or own those manuscripts to collect images of these manuscripts and to be able to preserve them digitally, right? And a variety of other projects as well that we can then, with this infrastructure that we're building, link up these projects. And so we're training people how to do this sort of thing.
Is there a certain concession when you're doing this that you may not always be able to physically protect these objects and this this kind of data?
Well, yeah, that's been a difficult a difficult thing to deal with in the past, the colonial response was to say, well, we'll take it and protect it in Europe, right? We'll take it and protect it in America. Of course, a lot of this happened just prior to World Wars I and II, at which point there were serious questions as to whether or not having them in Europe was a good idea, right? But also it was taking the cultural heritage of these people away from them. And so I think there's been a real sense of wanting to keep the objects with the people who should have them, but also to preserve them for both them and for the scholarly community that wants access to them as well. And that's what's so wonderful about the digital, that it allows us to do that.
And it's all free. Anyone who has a computer, has access to the internet, has access to our data. It's free and open.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what is the feeling of the people whose heritage it is that you are trying to preserve about this work that you're doing? I mean, obviously, they are not here to answer.
Yes.
But
Well, there's really a new model developing that is this post-colonial model, as Dan was saying. And so we're seeing a tremendous involvement on the ground from people who partner, for example, with the Hill Museum and Manuscript Library in Minnesota, which goes around to these monasteries all over the Middle East, has local employees who photograph and digitize these manuscripts and make them available across the entire world. And so one of the incredible challenges of the Syriac communities is that many of them are no longer in their homelands.
Mm-hmm.
They're in exile in various places. And this kind of digitization work on the ground in Middle Eastern monasteries allows somebody in Toronto or Chicago or England to access their own communal heritage.
When you see one of these places that you're studying show up in the news the day after you were doing work on it or the week after or whatever, does the thought pop into mind that the clock is really ticking on this work that you're doing?
I think so, absolutely. You don't exactly know. We don't know, unfortunately, how the story is going to end, and things can change. I mean, we all, Dan and I, were sort of trained at the beginning of 2000. Mm-hmm. At that time, the world already looked very different. Mm-hmm. Things shift very quickly. It's very delicate, and there's just the intersection of the protection of the heritage and the places and also the people.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely not a case where, you know, the Western scholars with the knowledge are preserving the cultural heritage of one of our project partners, Beit Marduthu, the Syriac Institute. I mean, they're doing incredible work from within that heritage community in terms of online dictionaries, digital encyclopedias, right? So this is very much a shared endeavor. This is not collaboration between scholars interested in this material and people who are a part of the community as well.
Do you see what you're doing? Is there a difference between doing this from a spiritual or religious level and from a pure linguistic level?
That's an interesting question. I think there are people from across the board in terms of their theological background and orientation who are involved in this kind of work.
Right.
I can think of atheists, I can think of Jews, I can think of people who are a part of this heritage community, the Syrian Orthodox and Church of the East, but also sort of Roman Catholic, evangelical, Christian. I mean, sort of a broad range of theological interests have brought people to this historical period, this body of literature. And that's actually a nice part of the field as well, that people are coming from all over the place. It's not as though it's sort of just one religious community preserving itself.
Right. And then speaking on behalf of the Marquette Theology Department, I enjoy teaching this material to my students very much because it's Syriac theology has a very different approach to the study of God. And I think the students can often find that very, very much a balance with the Greek and Latin traditions. And so it's nice to have a sort of wide umbrella approach. And they learn also insights into Jesus's tradition better because he was Aramaic. And that's fun to show them that as well.
I think, like Dan was saying, people from a lot of different religious perspectives as well as different disciplines find this material interesting because you have everything from the history of science, history of philosophy, to
Absolutely.
Theology, poetry exactly. And so people will find different angles from which they find this interesting. And for myself personally, I find it very enriching to be able to, for example, walk into a Syriac service and recognize these texts that maybe I've read being sung and experience that in a very living way. But each person is going to have a different angle that they find it interesting.
What do you see is at risk here? What happens if the world loses this language and this historical tradition and this heritage?
I'd want to start by going back to what I said a moment ago about the thriving of Syriac as a language and as a linguistic culture in its heyday and beyond. Right? I think the most immediate thing that's lost is a notion of a diverse, vibrant, religiously diverse, vibrant Middle East. Right? Mm-hmm. The notion that the Middle East is or ought to be somehow religiously monolithic is a historical error. And to forget that, I think, has really dire consequences. And so that, I think, is probably one of the most fundamental. But then also just to realize the place of this culture in a much wider intellectual scope, as I was referring to earlier. And as Nathan just mentioned again, you know, philosophy, poetry, rhetoric, you know, natural science, all of these sorts of things were very much taken up by people writing in Syriac, and they had a vibrant intellectual tradition in that regard.
And it's not just in the Middle East. We should note one of the largest Syriac heritage communities is actually in southern India, mm-hmm. very vibrant communities in Kerala and the Malankara and mm-hmm. Malabar traditions. And Syriac missionaries traveled in the 7th century all the way to China, bringing mm-hmm. their form of Christianity all the way to China. And so they've always been a group that have been widely interacting with different cultures mm-hmm. as well.
I think we could also zoom out on what Dan said and not only see the Middle East for all its religious diversity, but also look at religious history on a world dimension. Mm-hmm. And at the present moment, it appears almost as if, for example, Christianity is primarily in North America and Europe. And that's because of the last 100 years. But when we zoom out and look at the last 2,000 years, we see that that's really just a blip on the map. And mm-hmm. and when we look ahead to what may be coming, we see that it may be going in a very different direction.
Africa in particular.
Right. Right?
Yeah,
exactly.
No question.
So do the three of you each speak Syriac?
We can all say a few words.
Say a few words, yeah.
Most of this week's workshop will play out in English, however.
Exactly, yes. So our Syriac.org, we have a lot. If you go to our website, you'll see a fair bit of Syriac. We're working with projects that are digitizing Syriac texts, for example, and we're in the process of integrating those more fully into what we do. But we are an English language resource, although there's German and French and mm-hmm. a little bit of Spanish and those things
Russian.
In there as well. Some Russian, yes. But yeah, we're basically an English language project.
You cannot yet learn Syriac in Duolingo.
Not yet. But George Karaz may get there.
So
who knows?
We have one participant coming who speaks it very well and is always
yes.
trying to get more people to speak it,
yes.
the spoken language. So.
All right. Well, Dan, Nathan, Jean-Nicole, thank you so much. And best of luck in your work.
Thank you.
Thank
it's
you.
Been a delight.
It's been a great pleasure.
Jean-Nicole Melon-Saint-Laurent is an assistant professor of historical theology at Marquette University. Dan Schwartz is a professor in the history department at Texas A&M University. And Nathan Gibson is a postdoctoral scholar specializing in digital humanities at Vanderbilt University. His research base is in Munich, Germany.
The Mapping Ancient Lives and Social Networks workshop at Marquette wraps up this evening with a public keynote address by French scholar Muriel Debier. There is a link to more information at WUWM.com.